Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Just ahead, we're digging into how our government works and what we really know about the process. In school, we're taught a subject known as civics, but it turns out that information isn't really sticking, with half of us unable to name the very basics, including the three branches of government, according to a recent survey. This morning, we're looking at why that's the case and what needs to be done to fix the problem. In California, interacting with your government often means engaging with clunky, outdated websites in what's considered to be the most tech-savvy of states. Updating the system is a large task. Governor Gavin Newsom has had some success with advancing tech in government, but the pandemic has exposed shortfalls, and there's much more to be done. Cap Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd recently wrote about California's challenge in modernizing state government and joins us now to discuss that. Welcome, Scott, as always.
Thanks for having me on.
So give us a bit of the lay of the land here. Where does California stand in terms of being a tech-savvy government?
Not great, frankly. There are a lot of outdated systems in California. Some of these computer systems going back decades that, you know, have been in place and maybe they were, you know, sort of cutting edge at the time. But as of right now, many of these systems are outdated. That said, California does a fairly good job of when a new system or a new, say database has to be set up. They do a pretty good job of starting things from scratch and forming partnerships, especially under Newsom, with Silicon Valley. But as far as these legacy systems go, it's pretty hit or miss.
Are there some portals that really stand out as like shining examples of how well we do, or the opposite of that? You know, for instance, maybe the DMV site or EDD?
I would say, let's start with EDD. That's probably right now the one that's on most Californians' minds as being a system that is not very efficient, not very effective. That's one where, if you name it, they have it, or they don't have it, I should say. Customer service is lacking. The online interfaces are hard to navigate. It's hard to get a response from the department, and their computer systems are very old, frankly. And in fact, their system for unemployment insurance runs on a computer language that's like 60 years old. Mm. So that is a clear example of a government system that is just very outdated. And right now we're placing 21st century pandemic demands on this very old system.
Yeah. It's an overall odd area for California to struggle. I'm curious about what the state's online footprint looks like compared to others. Do we know how California stacks up to other states in the country?
You know, it can be hard to compare. I think in general, government has a reputation for not always being on the cutting edge. Things move a bit slower. If, say, tech, and borrowing this from Facebook's motto, is, move fast and break things, government's motto is more like move slow and, make sure we don't break anything. That's sort of more so their motto. They have a much more cautious attitude, especially when it comes to, updating technology. And partly because there are risks involved with that, right? Silicon Valley can take risks with tech and they may work or they may not. With government, there's a lot on the line. People's lives and livelihood, quite literally, are on the line with government and government services. So there is a lot at stake.
Yeah. You mentioned the pandemic. Has it caused delays with modernization, or has it created urgency to speed up the process? Or both?
Yes. I'll answer both with yes. It's exposed just how lacking some of these systems are, just how inefficient they are. And I think it's created a challenge with trying to figure out ways to update it, because right now, so much of everyday life, so much of what previously may have been inefficient processes are complicated by the pandemic. You have much of state government working remotely right now. That is a serious juggling act on its own. So figuring out ways to not only do that, but execute updating these systems that have been a challenge to update in normal times, that's certainly going to be an added challenge. You know, that said, the pandemic has, in exposing some of these problems, has created urgency. Newsom has talked about these things. Others, everyday Californians, have seen this and witnessed it and experienced it firsthand. So there is an added urgency and pressure, and lawmakers are voicing this as well. So I would say both in answer to your question.
Yeah. Scott, what was the plan prior to the pandemic for addressing California's tech issues?
I mean, Newsom came in, and he is a tech evangelist. That's what I refer to him as in my story. You know, he is someone who subscribes to the idea that, you know, tech can solve a lot of problems. And on that same note, government is, he says, fixing the disastrous state of government's tech systems is its greatest challenge. That's a direct line from his book, Citizenville. And so he came in wanting to fix tech in government. And a great example of that is the DMV. I mean, the DMV was frankly a mess when he entered office, and kind of was for a while before he entered office. But he made that one of his first efforts to really take on government inefficiency and outdated government head on. And, you know, he's had some successes with it. He was able to, you know, update its website, update its interfaces. He was able to, you know, he created one of his patented strike teams for DMV. And they did make some updates to the system. However, you know, right now the pandemic has created a situation where the DMV isn't being fully tested by the masses. You know, many DMV offices have been closed for a while. There have been sort of pushbacks and requirements in terms of when you have to get certain ID updates, et cetera. So the system hasn't been fully tested, but people look at that as, you know, an example of Newsom at least taking a head-on approach to trying to fix a tech problem.
Scott, you spoke with Amy Tong, the state's chief information officer and director of the California Department of Technology, and you do have some sound from her. Can you set it up for us a bit?
Sure. Yeah, we spoke about this issue of tech in government and the challenges that the administration faces. And she had a really interesting point, and I'll let her take it from here.
There's a huge culture change that needs to happen to make sure the people that are running the program, people running the operations, are comfortable. Technology alone is not the panacea.
So, yeah, so Amy Tong is saying that technology isn't the silver bullet. What does she mean by that people are comfortable?
I mean, essentially what she's talking about is winning the hearts and minds of public employees who have, for a very long time, done things a certain way. And, you know, that way of doing things is with the existing, now outdated systems. And, you know, when she talks about changing the culture of government to match the technology, you know, an example she used was in replacing, say, a system like EDD that's grown very unwieldy and probably at some point will have to be replaced completely. In rebuilding it or building something new, they would like to take what's called a modular approach, where you have different sort of pieces of a much larger system set up so that if something needs to be updated or changed or swapped out, you can just grab that piece, update it, change it, and put it back in. And that's great on the tech side, but that takes a whole new way of thinking on the side where public employees, public servants have to interact with that system. So that takes a whole mindset shift. And she's talking, she says that that's one of the biggest challenge, maybe the biggest challenge when it comes to updating government technology.
And you can see it on smaller scales. I'm sure everybody listening has had some type of new technology roll in where they've worked. We've had it here at Cap Radio on, you know, on a regular basis. Something new is introduced, and it can take a while sometimes for all of us to embrace it fully. So you can only imagine on a scale the size of California how long that could take. And if you don't do it maybe in this modular fashion, like she mentioned, it might be a challenge.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned just a bit ago Gavin Newsom's 2013 book, Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. That's the full title of the book. We have another clip of the governor talking about it. Let's hear that.
And I wrote a book about being on the leading and cutting edge of 1976 in terms of our IT. And trust me, that's been made abundantly clear to not just me, to all of you. In this last year.
Why is what he's saying there so relevant to this conversation?
And right, I'm glad you brought up Citizenville again. I mentioned it earlier. You know, this book really is a manifesto about how to update state government and make it more technologically efficient and modern. And I thought that that quote, which was from just a couple weeks ago when he gave his latest budget proposal unveiling, you know, here we are in 2021. And he is making the same point now that he did in his 2013 book, which is that, you know, 8 years ago, state government was on the cutting edge of 1976 technology. And 8 years later, we're in the same place. And that shows that things haven't really moved much. And it's such an intractable issue to try to take on changing state government technology, especially in a state so big as California. That to me was revealing when he said that.
Has his actions matched then what he says in the book?
I think in terms of attitude and mentality of trying to update state government, keeping on this issue, speaking about it, and pushing his agencies and departments to try to advance the technology that they work with. Yeah, I think that they have matched his words. However, I think, you know, he did a number of the things that he mentioned in his book as mayor of San Francisco. I think in taking on state government technology, he's met quite a match. It is, again, a huge issue. It's a huge wall of a problem that I'm sure he knew this going into the job. He was lieutenant governor for a while. I'm sure he saw this as he was writing the book. And so it is quite a challenge. So I think in terms of matching his words of achieving it, that's still a work in progress.
I want to go in a little bit of a different direction here. You spoke with the director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, Nines Ponce. She spoke to you about demographic disparities. Let's hear what she had to say.
However, it has not done such a good job in providing more detailed data within those big racial ethnic categories. So, for example, for the Asian American category, there's no public-facing data that shows what the case rates are and what the death rates are for Chinese, for Filipinos, for Japanese, for Vietnamese.
I think we actually may have missed the first part of that bite, so I don't want to give short shrift to Newsom and his administration. Actually, Ms. Ponce was actually saying that the system that the administration has built for presenting COVID data in terms of cases, hospitalizations, death rate, all of that stuff is pretty good. She and some others who I've heard from as well say that the state's system that they set up for presenting this information to the public and researchers is good, and she says better than most states, actually. That last bit that we heard, she said where they could improve is breaking down some more detailed information. They, in fact, collect data, say, on more specific racial groups and communities, and that's her exact area of research. And she says, I often have to file records requests for this stuff, and that's just so inefficient. They have the information. It'd be great if they presented it without that kind of extra nudging. But again, she says, on the whole, that's an example of the administration building a system more or less from scratch and it working pretty well.
Finally, Scott, just about every issue you can think of has become extremely partisan in today's world. Is modernizing government on the high tech side considered partisan?
It's tough to say. You know, we look at something like EDD or even DMV, and you'll see folks from Newsom's own party expressing frustration, calling for changes. And you'll see folks on the other side of the aisle as well doing the same thing. I mean, former Senate Republican leader Shannon Grove, this has been, you know, a consistent talking point for her. So, you know, issues like that will be a bipartisan whipping post, let's say. Mm. However, when it comes time to actually make the changes, that's where it gets a little more partisan. These are extremely expensive changes that talking about. So once you start getting into the nitty gritty of how much this is going to cost, who's going to do this work, that's when it gets to be a little more partisan.
Yeah, we talk about it coming from the governor, but is there any legislation to address the issue?
EDD, you're seeing some legislation right now. Again, that's such a public forward-facing issue that people are coming up against, in their day-to-day lives. And that, quite literally, it's making the difference between people being able to buy groceries or not if they're not getting their unemployment checks. We're also seeing, you know, billions of dollars in fraud. You know, that's taxpayer money. So you're seeing some legislation on that front as well.
Yeah. Scott, you have such a great sense of what's a story and what's not a story. And it's just always a pleasure to have you on Insight and talk about these things. Thank you so much for all your hard work.
Always happy to be on. And thank you very much, Randall. Appreciate it.
Scott Rodd is Cap Radio's state government reporter. And up next, a closer look at civics in the U.S. and how education could hold the key to solving some of the democratic challenges we face today. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station. We're Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, and we're back in just a moment. You are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio on this Monday morning. I'm your host, Randall White, and our big conversation today is on civics and what appears to be a lack of understanding in the U.S. related to how our government works, our rights, our responsibilities, really, as citizens. We just talked about why modernizing California government has been such a challenge for Governor Gavin Newsom during his time in office. Getting California government with its many bureaucracies and still ancient computer systems, as Scott Rodd pointed out, fully up to speed with current day standards has proven a big task. In his 2013 book, Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government, Newsom describes how governments need to be tech savvy and open with data to the public. And then in return, people will become more engaged in the civic process. Some say civics has been sidelined in our education system over the years, making way for more math and sciences, two very good topics, of course, more testing. The result, however, is that too many Americans lack a basic understanding of how government works. According to a recent survey out of the University of Pennsylvania, half of those questioned could not identify the three branches of government. Charles Salter is a former teacher and superintendent and is the current president and COO of the News Literacy Project based in Washington, D.C., and he joins us on Insight right now. Nice to have you here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so Charles, I will switch to Chuck here at your suggestion. And how do you define civics specifically?
Right. Well, first and foremost, there is not one standard definition of what civics is. And that's actually part of the problem. Mm. In terms of education, each of the 50 states defines this differently and prioritizes it differently. But when I get asked that question, I answer it this way, that civics is a combination of subjects and disciplines such as government, economics, history, news literacy, critical thinking, combined with experiences such as debating and community service conducted over multiple years that seek to have students appreciate and understand the complexities of the country, mm-hmm. right? And think critically about that complexity, and most importantly, prepare them to live in the country and participate in its civic life.
Yeah.
It's not really a question of loving the country or hating the country in very polarized terms. It's more about how to actually exist in it.
Given that all 50 states make their own decision on what this is and how it's taught and all of that, and your position where you are, do you have a sense of which states are getting this right and which ones aren't?
So I actually don't, but I can tell you that, you know, where states are is pretty much all over the place right now. So we have 36 states that require students take a civics course sometime in their high school years, but only eight of those require a year-long course. And of all 50 states, only 19 of them test civics as a graduation requirement. So it is really a piecemeal approach, as we have no real national education system for anything, especially for civics, that each state defines it on their own. And there are some states that, you know, within that list require more of students than other states do. But primarily, civics has been probably over the last 40 or 50 years somewhat deprioritized in favor of other subjects that were deemed more important for national security and national prosperity, things like math, science,
the STEM,
general literacy, right, things like that.
So in some cases, you could say that somebody trying to gain citizenship here in the United States and pass a test might know more than somebody born here who graduated through our school system in some states. Might know more about our government. Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm fairly certain it's been proven that most American citizens can't pass the citizenship test that is required for immigrants to become citizens. So that's probably our first bellwether that we're not doing a good enough job in preparing current citizens that actually grew up here and went to school in the country to participate in our civic dialogue and our civic life.
Does it surprise you when you hear studies like the one out of the University of Pennsylvania where half of the respondents couldn't name the three branches of government?
None whatsoever. So with the News Literacy Project, we're really interested in the First Amendment and freedom of the press and the role of a press in a free democracy. And, you know, there's similar statistics that the vast majority of Americans can't name a single right that is guaranteed in the First Amendment or can't name three of the five. And it really shows that while we profess I have rights or you're violating the Constitution or you can't do that, it's interesting and disturbing how little Americans actually understand what is in the Constitution.
When you hear on the news that there are elected leaders who say that their First Amendment rights are being taken away, that they're being muzzled, that they no longer have their freedom of speech, do you believe it is on the journalists presenting that information to explain why that's not the case?
Well, someone should. That, quite frankly, the First Amendment protects people's freedom of speech from the government. And so whenever you're dealing with private industry, I think the most current debate would be if people are being silenced on social media, Twitter or Facebook. These are private platforms and private companies who have and enforce their own rules. Now, we can take issue with whether those rules are sufficient or if they are applied consistently. But this idea that your First Amendment rights are being violated when you're censored or cut out from a platform like Facebook simply isn't true. And also, I think the irony is lost on the speakers most of the time when they're actually on a national news broadcast
saying
talking
that,
about
right.
how they're being muzzled, you know, or censored. It's a privilege most of us don't enjoy.
Voter turnout has grown from 2018 to 2020. What's the correlation between civics education and then civic engagement that we might be able to measure based on people who get out and vote?
So I think one could only hope that with greater civics education, we would then foster greater civic engagement. I think recent voter turnout grew due to a heightened interest in politics, particularly during the Trump presidency. People had a real-time civics education over the past 4 years. We learned some and then wanted to engage more. And so I think you saw the growth in 18 and then 20. And I'm all for it. I think voter participation and voter engagement is a key sign of civic health. But I would hope that if we adopted a more robust and more universal civics education program across the country, that would contribute to not only greater engagement, but a more informed public that is engaging civically as well.
Other than voting, are there good ways to measure civic engagement?
So I think voter participation is the primary way, of course. But I also think rates of volunteerism, community activism, military service, AmeriCorps service — I was an AmeriCorps member a long time ago — and memberships in community-minded organizations such as Kiwanis would be good measures. You know, when an individual is exposed to people with different backgrounds or opinions, and when they work toward a common purpose that's greater than just an individual, this is the type of civic engagement that strengthens ties in a democratic society, and something we'd really want to measure and call out as a good sign that our civic life is healthy.
Yeah. Chuck, you wrote back in November that educators must be on the front lines of democracy. As a former superintendent, you've been critical of the amount of time spent on testing and test prep. How can schools prioritize civics and still get in all the other subjects that, you know, the parents are demanding?
Right. So I think as a general rule, I'd love to see a greater emphasis in education on critical thinking and other higher order thinking, rather than the paradigm we have now, which really focuses on rote memorization or test taking to regurgitate facts. I think we need to turn more to real world application and real world experiences. Mm-hmm. So for us, I think, you know, we're stuck in also this paradigm of heavy test taking. I remember when I was a superintendent, my staff came to me and explained how they spend over 30 days worth of instruction on test preparation, just helping students take the test rather than actually learning anything concrete. And I remember arguing as a student in high school in the 90s that why should I take, and I know I'll probably get in a lot of trouble for this, but why should I take a fourth year of math or science? Why do I need to take AP calculus or AP physics when, as an attorney and as a former educator, I've never used, and I feel fairly well informed and well educated, that we don't necessarily have to prioritize the math and science mm-hmm. the way we are now. Because if you tell teachers, oh, we're going to add civics education and there will be five more classes students have to take, teachers will ask, when are we supposed to handle that? And where will it fit in a student's schedule? I think we can actually, I shouldn't use the word deprioritize, but I think we can reprioritize some of the subject matters that are required for students to graduate, remembering that the point of public education, one of its foundational points, was to prepare the public for civic engagement. And we really shouldn't walk away from that and make it at least as important as having literate and math capable citizens as well.
Just briefly here, a group of Rhode Island students sued that state back in 2018 saying they'd been denied a civics education. How did that play out? Has it finished playing out in the courts?
It did. It did. The judge, basically, on almost a technicality, said he was not empowered to grant them what they wanted because, again, education is a state government mandate, not really the federal government. So he had no authority to help. However, the reason it gained so much attention was that the judge sympathized with the students and said that absolutely we need this kind of education in our country, and even pointed, I believe, to just kind of current events and sort of a lack of general knowledge around how government works, the role of the free press, the role of a citizen in making our democracy work. So it was, I'm proud of those students. And, you know, it's movements like that, I think, that are going to get movements across this all 50 states started.
Yeah, those students and their fellow students probably learned a lot about the court system too, which is part of the whole education
I'm
system,
sure they
right?
did.
Right?
Yeah. Yes, yes, especially the difference between state and federal judicial systems.
Right.
Yes.
Charles Salter is a former teacher and superintendent and is the current president and COO of the News Literacy Project based in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us today, and stay warm and I guess stay home, right? You got that nor'easter going through?
Absolutely. We're safe and warm at home. Thanks for having me.
Sounds good, Chuck. Thank you. Civics education is not a silver bullet, but civics educators and advocates say a more complete curriculum can help solve some of the democratic challenges that we face in America today. Alan Solomont is a former ambassador to Spain and Andorra during the Obama administration and serves as the dean of the Tisch School of Civic Life at Tufts University. And he joins us now. Really nice to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So, Dean Solomont, how has civic education changed over the years? How have you seen it change?
Well, I think that I think it's been overtaken by other educational priorities, and has actually become less prominent in the education of elementary and high school students, with the results that students are much less well educated in how our government works, in the principles of our democracy. I wrote an article recently, which I think prompted this your invitation, about what happened in this country on the morning of 1957 when Americans awoke to the news that the Soviet Union, our arch enemy at the time, had just launched a satellite into orbit around the Earth. That was our Sputnik moment, and America became very concerned about science and engineering education, really committed itself to that. And I would say that STEM education over the last decade has only grown more important, but it has flourished at the expense of civic education and education about American history, about American government. So today we spend over $50 per enrolled student on STEM education across the country, and about a nickel, 5 cents, on civic education.
Wow. Do you think, you mentioned the whole Sputnik situation really spurring interest in science and those sorts of things. Could a positive outcome to what we saw happen at the nation's capital last month spur interest in civics now?
I hope so. I did write that the events that took place on January 6th, perhaps more threatening than a threat from a foreign adversary, might be a wake-up call and might get people thinking about the state of our democracy and how we can do a better job at educating young people to participate responsibly in our democracy, to have faith in our democratic institutions, and to focus on factual information and to avoid the kind of breakdown that we've just seen that was represented by what happened in Washington on the 6th of January.
Mm-hmm. You think social media has a big impact there?
I do. Let me say more generally, American democracy was based on a foundation of strong civic institutions, going back to before the Republic was founded. You know, Benjamin Franklin created the first all-volunteer fire department in Philadelphia because the wood frame houses were burning and there was no government. And so he organized citizens to do that. Over the years, we've seen institutions like, as just mentioned by your previous guest, Kiwanis Club, or labor unions, church suppers, a daily newspaper that gives everyone kind of the same factual information. A whole range of civic activities and civic institutions really have underpinned our democracy over the decades and centuries. And I think what we've seen over the last few decades is a deterioration in those civic institutions. And I don't know that we've really figured out how to replace them in the 21st century. So it used to be that people got their daily newspaper delivered to their doorstep. They might have gotten the paper because they wanted to read the funnies or the sports page or the weather. But everybody got more or less the same headlines and the same factual information. When I was a college student, I recall after dinner every night, we would watch either Dan Rather, Walter Cronkite, or Harry Reasoner on the three networks. And we were, in those days, watching news about the Vietnam War. We may have differed in our opinions about what was going on, but we all were operating from the same set of facts. Today, we have hundreds of sources of information, very little filter about what information is factually accurate. So I think your point is extremely well taken. Social media has a real deleterious effect on this.
Dean Solomon, ideally, how would you like to see this issue tackled in the schools, or when would you like to see civics education begin? How would you twist and turn things to really to make for a better society?
How about second grade?
Second grade?
Public television, or WGBH, which is one of the flagship public television stations of the country, is using the cartoon character Arthur to teach second graders some of the principles of civic responsibility, tolerance, for diversity, getting along with one another. So it's never too early to begin to teach some of the basic principles of the fact that we all live in communities with other people, and we have to look out for other people. I mean, that's what civics is about, actually. But I think that we really do have to start in early grades in elementary school, carry on to high school and then to college. Learning and participating about civic life should be a lifetime endeavor.
Yeah.
I'll give you one example, if I may. I think many people were impressed by the high school students who survived the Parkland shootings in Florida, and were impressed with how articulate and effective they were in getting their message out. One of the reasons is because they had been studying civics since middle school. There's actually a very strong requirement in the state of Florida, the Sandra Day O'Connor Civic Education Act, which was signed 2010. It's not been supported, sadly, as much as it could be by most more recent state governments in Florida. But it does require every student in Florida in middle school and high school to study civics. And we saw the effect on a group of high school students who were very effective participants in our democracy.
I think they got 1 million people to turn out, didn't they, for the March for Our Lives in 2018?
Yeah.
And, you know, the education in my life started young with Schoolhouse Rock. I had a really good sense of how a bill became a law based on that little cartoon. So maybe
you're just a youngster to me. Now, you know that there's a piece of legislation that's been proposed in the Congress, a bipartisan piece of legislation. I mean, the good news is there is an emerging movement to correct some of this imbalance and to restore the importance of civic education in our schools. So Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro and Congressman Tom Cole, Senators Chris Coons and John Cornyn, Democrats and Republicans, intend to file legislation called the Education for Democracy Act in the next Congress to try to put some money into the federal budget that would be available to states to give them the opportunity to improve education in both civics and history. There's another effort called Educating for American Democracy, which is a national effort actually funded by the Department of Education and the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's trying to create a national roadmap for the teaching of civics and history, also bringing together people with different political ideologies. This is something that I think people who may differ on the issues, but who agree on the importance of civics need to come together and really push hard on.
Yeah, so some positive movement there. Alan Solomont is a former ambassador to Spain and Andorra during the Obama administration and serves as the dean of the Tisch School of Civic Life at Tufts University. Really appreciate you taking time to share your perspective with us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me on. Take good care.
You bet. You too. Still ahead, diversity in civics and civic education, why it matters and the impact it can have on government. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Getting students involved in the democratic process and familiar with the way government works creates more engaged citizens who are able to then make the change they want to see in the world. Our big conversation this morning is on civics and what appears to be a lack of understanding in the U.S. related to how our government works, our rights and responsibilities as citizens. Christopher Riano is the president of the Center for Civic Education and lecturer in constitutional law and government at Columbia University. He joins us with some perspective on this aspect of our civics discussion this morning. Welcome to Insight, Christopher. Nice to have you here.
Hey, thank you so much. It's so wonderful to be able to join this morning.
Yeah, it's been a great conversation so far, and I know you're really going to add to it. So I'm wondering, how can we improve civic education through the lens of diversity?
You know, I love that question because I think traditionally we've always looked at civic education as a K through 12 venture, and that's not a bad thing. But we really do need to expand our view and our vision of the inclusivity that civic education presents to ensure that a civic and constitutional education is a lifelong journey. It's something that all members of our society can participate in. And I think that's actually very critical. Unlike the amount of, you know, I celebrate math and science, those subjects are critical, but every one of us has civic moments inside classrooms, inside work. You know, everywhere we go, it's very different than other fields. So I think when it comes to finding and building an inclusive civic experience and constitutional experience as Americans, we should, we can, and we really need to think more broadly.
Mm-hmm. What would be some elements of that, elements of diversity that you would like to see included in that education process?
Well, I think in many ways, we have to embrace the various different viewpoints and perspectives that come when it comes to a civic and constitutional education. Now, I'm the first that will celebrate the importance of understanding history and the fact that, yeah, it's good to know what happened in 1787. But at the same time, we also have to think about how we teach people to engage in their communities. And I don't think that those two things are necessarily exclusive. Mm. You know, by celebrating what is a strength in American democracy, recognizing the weaknesses that do exist in our American system, and then finding ways to ensure that at the community, the state, and the federal level, we can engage to overcome and do better when it comes to those weaknesses. I think that's a process that it involves everybody, and you have to have those diverse perspectives. You have to include people in those conversations to make a difference.
And I guess we know because we've seen examples of it in the past, but what happens when we don't include those diverse voices in that conversation moving forward?
You know, we have an incredibly diverse society. What it means to have a democratic republic means that while it is a majority rule system, you have to celebrate and you have to protect minority rights. It's the only way that it works. And when you have so many different viewpoints, you have to ensure that you don't place yourself into echo chambers, that you are open to different ideas. It's the very definition of how a democracy has to function. And so in many ways, you have to ensure that people are in the room, and you have to be open to hearing things that you might not otherwise necessarily be immediately thinking of when it comes to the way in which our society functions and the way in which our society could function better.
Why does it seem like there used to be more of a tolerance for that in the past, and that people, politicians, have siloed themselves in what you called an echo chamber, and those diverse voices aren't making their way in as often as they did?
Oh, I would be the first to say it's not necessarily easy. But I'm also the first that would argue, and I'd say this to my students all the time, in my constitutional law classes, in my work, if that's not a safe space to have difficult conversations, I don't know where else we can have those conversations. Mm-hmm. We have to be open to pushing ourselves to new ideas and be open to debating and having dialogue about both what's good about the way that the system functions, but also what's weak about the system. It's through those discussions and dialogues that we can create better opportunities for change and find ways to inclusively look at how to address those weaknesses. It's not going to ever be perfect. It's a democratic system. The idea in a democracy, in a democratic republic, is that we do include a diverse set of voices. But just because it's not easy, it doesn't mean that it's not important to ensuring, you know, our civil society is as strong as it can be.
And I guess examples of where it falls down that you were talking about are with racial and economic inequities, right?
I think that we have to always think about social justice as a very broad and critical thing to be thinking of, especially because that's a huge part of our American historical fabric. So when it comes to racial justice or LGBTQ rights, or looking broadly at the way in which the women's rights movement has progressed over the years, they're all actually more similar in many ways than we sometimes think about. But I think it's through looking at those similarities, we find something very unique. As much as I celebrate the various differences that exist in America, and we should celebrate those differences, it is the kickoff of Black History Month, and we're doing a big push on that at the Center for Civic Education. There's a lot more that brings us together than divides us. And it's much easier to focus on the divisions, but we really have to constantly push ourselves to remember that there's a lot more that actually is a unifying force. And it's through those discussions, those difficult ones we were talking about before, that we can find ways to bring ourselves together to solve the difficult problems of today.
That's so true, Christopher. It's so much easier to focus on the divisions. You know, in news, when we're looking at stories, one of the tests to see if it's a story is there conflict? And conflict doesn't have to be like this negative thing. There has to be sort of one thing saying this and one thing saying that type of thing. And so from a news perspective, and that's where, you know, we get a lot of our information in the U.S. about what's going on. The focus is almost always on this conflict and not the things that bring us together, as you mentioned.
Yeah, on division, right? Because that's easy. And it's easy because it's easy to set that up where you can have somebody say, well, I believe in this perspective, or, well, that doesn't make any sense. I don't believe in that. I believe against that. It's a lot harder to instead have those conversations where you come into the room and say, we may have differences. That's okay. It's not a bad thing. In fact, that actually can be a good thing. So let's think about those differences and use them with our civic and constitutional toolkits in order to find ways to strengthen democracy in America. And I think that's possible. And I just think it's a conversation that we need to continually have as a society.
Mm-hmm. What do you think makes a civic and constitutional education unique and unlike other areas of study in about a minute or so?
Absolutely. You know, I often will talk with people and I'll say, you know, again, as much as I celebrate science and math, I don't come into my everyday work, and most students don't go into their every single day classroom talking about a hypotenuse. It's right. Just not how this happens. And yet, every classroom, every workplace, every single moment, we do have civic moments. We are thinking about, well, what happened today in my local government? And why did that stoplight not work outside of my school? And how do I make a difference in my community, not just by voting and not just, you know, through jury service, but in my community organizations and at my Rotary Club? I mean, that is what it means to be civically virtuous. That's the great American experiment. And I think we have to remind ourselves that it's not just on voting day that we are part of this, you know, work. It's every single day and every part of our lives in society. And that makes civics, that makes a constitutional education very different.
Yeah. Christopher Riano, president of the Center for Civic Education, lecturer in constitutional law and government at Columbia University. Thank you so much today for your information.
And thanks for having me.
And as I should have said to all of the guests, stay warm and safe. I know there's quite a storm out there today.
Thank you.
All righty. So that does it for Insight today. Thank you to producers Kyle McKinnon and Cynthia Lopez, managing editor Aram Sarkissian, digital team Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Our technical director is Mark Jones, engineer Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Randall White. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're back again tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.